Hi, and welcome to the latest episode of Security Nation, the podcast where we talk to interesting people doing cool things to advance security in some way. I feel like I need a new intro. It's getting stale. Anyway, I'm your host, Jen Ellis. I'm Rapid7's VP of Community and Public Affairs, and with me is my amazing co-host, Todd Beardsley, although he's not with me in person because we don't do that right now. There
we are not psychotic, no.
Not a thing. We are social distancing so well that we yes. are on different continents.
That's right. Yay. 6 feet tries, 6,000 miles.
Take that. Okay, and we have a very exciting guest. I always think our guests are exciting. I love them.
They wouldn't be here otherwise. It's kind of a Gen selecting population.
It'd be so great as well if I was like, this week we have a really boring guest. But it's not true this week. We have a great guest, who is Stephanie Helm, who is the director of the Massachusetts Cyber Center. Hey, Stephanie, how are you doing?
Great, Jen. Great, Todd.
Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. So the Mass Cyber Center, so Rapid7, for those who are not aware, is headquartered in Massachusetts. We are in Boston, right at the TD Garden where the Bruins play, which is a pretty awesome spot to be in. And we have beautiful offices. If you're in town, come and have a look. I am not there right now. I am in my brother's attic in somewhere outside Luton, which is a very different thing to being above the garden in Boston, but never mind. So Stephanie is going to tell us all about the Mass Cyber Center, which is actually still a relatively new initiative, but a very exciting one. Rapid7 are big fans of this, huge supporters. But before we get into any of that, Stephanie has like a fascinating background. Stephanie, tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I was in the Navy for 29 years, so that usually is sort of an odd thing for people to get wrap their head around. I have a degree in Slavic languages and literature. And I was recruited into the Navy because of my language background. And I became a cryptologist, which is a field that worked with GCHQ and National Security Agency. And it was a very interesting line of work. It transitioned into information warfare during the course of my career. And I had a number of very interesting tours. I was a commanding officer. I was assigned to the Second Fleet back in the day and was assigned to a ship then. Got to go to a NATO exercise in the Baltic, which was a lot of fun. Got to do a lot of interesting port calls as well as a lot of good work. And I had a tour at the Pentagon, the National Security Agency, and I ended up at the Naval War College teaching. And then after I retired, I worked in the war gaming department and I integrated cyber operations into traditional war games. So that was sort of my background before I joined the Massachusetts Cybersecurity Center.
I mean, that's a lot. Like, you've done a lot. That's kind of amazing. And super interesting. I mean, you were in the Navy at a time when there really weren't very many women serving in the Navy, right?
Oh, that's very true. Some of my best friends in the Navy were fellow women that were, we were often the only woman at a duty station. And so when you met somebody that was at a different duty station, they were the only woman. You kind of asked each other, well, how's it going? And what do you do here? And what do you do there? And I have a lot of good male friends and colleagues from the Navy as well. But there's just a special bond when you're kind of the first one to do a lot of different things. And that sadly was the way it was in many cases in my career, being the first here, the first there. And then by the time I retired, happily, there were a lot of women in the Navy and we were on ships and on aircraft, and then later they were on submarines. So more fully integrated now than when I joined, for sure.
We have one of our coworkers that we love and work closely with, Daryl Highland, who's the head of our IoT practice. He was on submarines for about 20 odd years, and I frequently have conversations with him where I just stare at him and I'm like, I don't understand how. How are you not insane? How did you do this?
Yeah.
It's like my worst nightmare. It takes a special person to be able to do that, I think. All part of you. So let's talk about the Mass Cyber Center. So how did this whole thing come about?
Well, it was an idea that came after Governor Baker visited Israel. It's one of the only outside of the United States trips that he's taken since he was governor. And he looked at Israel and the health sector that was there, as well as the cybersecurity sector. And he kind of came back and said, we can get our act together. For Massachusetts, we've got a lot of the elements that are really, really supportive of a good cybersecurity ecosystem. And we need a focal point for the state that kind of can help us do that. And so the center was established in 2017, and I joined the center in 2018. So I was the first director, and then subsequently have hired two employees. So there are three of us. But one of the things that helped the center get established was a thing called the Massachusetts Cybersecurity Strategy Council. Admiral Mike Brown, who's a retired admiral who I worked with on active duty, he's the president of the council, and it was created with really great people that are so supportive from academia, from the private sector, to help me kind of get guided as the center was established. So Corey Thomas is a member of the Cybersecurity Strategy Council. And when you say he's a special friend, Rapid7 is a special friend, I have a lot of special friends in that council that have helped me along the way, from things like trying to create a mission to try to understand where the strategy ought to go to. And then as we've tried to plan and execute key activities, the Strategy Council members have just been super helpful with providing input in guiding me through this, as well as providing their personal support or resources to help events happen.
So it's been 2 years, and I'm sure that it's been a crazy 2 years in that time.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And like, by the way, like, you know, congratulations on hiring. We should give a special shout out to your team, who are fantastic.
Yeah, we're a team of three. The strategy that we have settled upon, there are three main efforts in the center. One is dealing with the ecosystem, which is, you know, looking at all of the riches that Massachusetts has in terms of cybersecurity between companies and academics, and which has a good talent pipeline and research that's ongoing, as well as a lot of startups and a very vibrant investment community that looks to trying to capture new ideas and innovation and help them grow and get integrated and connected with the other parts of the cybersecurity ecosystem to make it really good. So ecosystem is one priority that we have. The second one is resiliency for the state, looking across the state as well as municipalities as well as citizens. And then the third one is just a general outreach communications awareness about what the heck is cybersecurity and why should I care and what can I do about it. And I would say that's a very important element of what we do, because it seems to be very daunting to people outside of cybersecurity or the IT world. They are not technical in nature perhaps, and so they're resistant to getting the whole spiel because it very quickly loses them. And so I think one of our elements has been trying to create awareness that is approachable to people so that they can better understand what the issues are related to cybersecurity. So those are the three priorities that we have within the center.
Yeah, so those are all really, really important things. How's it going?
I think it's going pretty well. You always think you can do more.
I was going to say, you don't sound like you're brimming with confidence as you say that. But then I also, you know, you well enough to know that that's partly because you're just a very humble person. You have a little bit of imposter syndrome, as don't we all in the security community.
Well, and I expect that security people are generally pessimists anyway, right? Like, we all try, right? We all try to be very optimistic about the things that we do.
Yeah.
We all see the, you know, we've made such strides here, and oh my God, look at these next three mountains we have to climb.
Right. I am looking at, there is a lot of work yet to do.
Well, you've bitten on it. I mean, like, when you say here are our three priorities, they are three massive priorities.
Yeah.
So it's not like you've like got like small projects. Those are huge. They have many sub projects, each of them. So it would be shocking if you didn't have a lot of work. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I would say we've worked an awful lot recently on the resiliency piece for municipalities.
Which is great.
I'll talk a little bit about that because given the COVID-19 response that is ongoing, this is really hitting local governments really in a hard way. There's a lot that they have on their plate. And as cybersecurity professionals already know, the adversaries are taking advantage of all of the flux, whether it be related to the ongoing uncertainty about how the COVID virus is going, whether it is about people transitioning workforces to work remotely, that people losing their jobs and stimulus packages and checks coming in the mail. All of those themes are things that the adversaries are using to try to get people to click on links that they ought not to, or to use the new architecture of the remote operations to potentially be an avenue that they can get into somebody's system.
Yeah.
So you'd like to think that they would be taking a break, but they're not. And the municipalities are seeing not a decrease in attacks, but if not the same, more. So we have continued to try to keep focus on the resiliency piece about where can we be helpful. And one good partner that we've had in this process has been members of our resiliency working group. We've got an ongoing working group that meets once a month. There's a sub working group focusing on municipalities. So if you go to our website, it's got a toolkit to help municipalities, which was started long before we got into this crisis. But because we have that resources capability on our website, we're using that to update things such as tips to do teleworking. If you're a municipal leader, here's some of the considerations you might want to take into account as your workforce goes to work remotely. If you're an employee, here are some of the things that you should be mindful of while you're working remotely. So we've done information on telework. We've also put together kind of a listing of links of information to resources such as the CISA.dhs.gov website. CISA is the critical cybersecurity and infrastructure security agency. They've got information on there about cybersecurity best practices and things that you should take into account and resources that you can use from them. So we've got things like the FEMA website that can help you with rumor control. So if you're trying to counter disinformation that you find on the internet, you can check this website. So we're trying to be as helpful as we can without getting in people's way, and it's a balance, but we know that the municipalities would appreciate to have some additional assistance. And as we can do that, we want to be helpful.
I mean, it sounds like you guys are being super helpful. And for an entity that's still, you know, relatively new, relatively young, still sort of, you know, navigating and to some extent getting off your feet, that's amazing. You know, it sounds like you've super hit the ground running in this particular situation. And I think that is one of the better things that's coming out of the COVID situation. I say looking for the silver lining, is that we have seen some really incredible response from some quarters, and it sounds like you guys have definitely used this as an opportunity to jump in and drive value where you possibly can and serve your community, which I think is really awesome. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, thank you. We've also had a lot of good partnership with the Massachusetts Municipal Association because they hear directly from the mayors, the town managers, and the select board on issues relating to municipalities. And so we've partnered with them as well to help us be, you know, sometimes they're a conduit of providing us information like we've heard people ask for this. And then also we've worked with them to try to push information out in a way that might be useful for the towns and cities.
So I do have a question, Stephanie. So who is your audience, and maybe this is a dumb question, is it like the municipality workers? Is it like political folks? Is it people who live in cities and towns, which is everyone? I'm just curious what your scope of your audience certificate.
Yeah, Todd, mostly we're trying to link through town leadership to whatever IT resource they might have or cybersecurity resource. Most of the cities, which might have a lot of cybersecurity assets that they need to have protected, probably already have a fairly strong IT team and even maybe a dedicated CISO. smaller cities and certainly at the towns, they may not have a CISO. They may not even have a dedicated IT person. And in some cases, some of these municipalities are so small, you know, the public works director is also the guy that, you know, checks the server every now and then or something. Sure. And it may not be that good a merit entry, but there are varying capabilities across the 351 municipalities. So one of the things that we've heard is that if you're the IT guy at a city or a town, you have a hard time making the case through leadership about why cybersecurity needs to continue to be funded. And some of that is because, you know, scarce resources, and it's a difficult decision for a small municipality to say, I need to buy another dump truck, or I need to buy additional cybersecurity resources. Not trying to second guess those decisions, but understanding that sometimes explaining why cybersecurity is an ongoing initiative that has to be resourced in order for it to be effective. It's not just buy one thing and you're done. It's the people, it's the process, and the technology working together on a regular basis to keep you safe. The other thing I think we've tried to do is tried to help make at least one thing as a priority for all the municipalities, and that has been having an incident response plan. We think that having an incident response plan, just the process of planning, brings up a lot of issues within a municipality as they put that plan together. So we, Mass Cyber Center, we're part of the Mass Tech Collaborative, which is a quasi-governmental organization under the Executive Office of Housing and Economic Development. We've got a contract that's about ready to hit the street as a selected contractor that's about ready to go create workshops throughout the state designed to have municipalities come together and, using a template, create their own incident response plan. And we're hoping that by providing a workshop environment, that the town, it's the leadership as well as the IT, as well as the cybersecurity people coming together to figure out what that incident response plan needs to be for their own individual municipality and how it fits in with their broader continuity of operations and their larger risk decision-making processes within their city or town. But we think that that is a way that we can help, through the workshop, communicate not only with the town leadership, but the IT and the cyber folks.
That's fantastic. I was involved in a project for some, you know, Massachusetts municipality government things just a little while ago. And that was when I first learned, like, this whole devolution of power throughout Massachusetts. Like, Massachusetts is rabid about local governance to the point where, like, basically everything just, the buck stops at, you know, the town manager, basically, right? And so listening to you talk has really, you know, helped me come to terms with, like, how Massachusetts does things, because it's not just these guys. Like, I've always, like, in the past couple of months, I've come to realize, like, town managers are often choosing between, you know, updated Windows licenses or filling potholes. And that's kind of a, that's kind of a wild budgeting process. But the fact that you're there to help them, especially with things like incident response plans, that fills my heart with joy. And I'm very happy, since my company is headquartered in Massachusetts, I'm glad to hear that it's not on the brink of chaos all of the time.
No. Well, you're right. Massachusetts is a home rule state. And so 351 different IT architectures and 351 different cybersecurity challenges, right? So you can't get too prescriptive about what you think people ought to do. There's some basic NIST guidelines and the CIS best practices that you'd like to promote. But we think approaching each town or city with their incident response plan tailored to their own needs and their own resource availability is very important. The other thing is, this is recognized by the state, and there's a program called the Community Compact, which is where municipalities can make an application that says, I would like to embark on improving my IT infrastructure or my cybersecurity infrastructure, and they can make a proposal to the state, get money for that, and then be able to fix some of their own identified problems. That program is independent of what we're doing, which is why we selected the incident response plan, because we think it dovetails nicely with other elements that the state is already trying to do through the community compact. And then the Executive Office of Technology Services and Security, they also have grants that they've awarded to support cybersecurity awareness training for employees in different municipalities. So there are elements across the government to try to reach out and help. And we're working together within our organizations to try to synchronize all of our efforts, including things that are done at the public safety level, to kind of come together and say, here's a menu of things available to you, municipality. We would like to help you be better resilient in this area.
So one of the things that, you know, you've hit on a lot in that, and is a big theme that I think is a common theme for security professionals, regardless of what particular world they are working in, is, you know, these themes around trying to get buy-in, often from a constituents that is perhaps not as sophisticated on security or as immersed in security as the security pro is, who also perhaps is trying to balance other priorities, other demands for budget, other considerations for the organization, and having to try and bring many stakeholders together and get people on the same page and working together, which, you know, obviously in the world you're in, there's a huge amount of politics associated with that. That's why it's called politics, in fact. But politics exists in any environment where you have groups of people. And so it's just as true in the corporate world as it is for you. So what advice would you give to people who, you know, are trying to get some sort of project, some sort of security project off the ground and get buy-in from other stakeholders and are struggling to do so?
Well, I'm not a technologist, right? I am the Slavic languages and literature person. So I...
So you rushed them until they gave in? Is that what happened?
I joined the cryptologic field, which was highly technical, and I had to learn how to grasp what the technical issue is and try to translate it so that I could understand it myself, right? I'm not naturally embedded into that technology field. And so I think that's one of the things that many times when the IT or the cyber security person is trying to convince someone of the importance of what they want to do, if it can easily get into language that the person that they're trying to convince is not a member of that language. And so translating that, and I'm not talking about dumbing it down, I'm talking about making it approachable, because the person they're talking to probably also knows a lot about the wastewater management system and sure. patching roads sure. and finance. I mean, there's yeah. a lot of complexity to running these municipalities, and this is also important and has to be presented in a language that is consistent with other decisions that they're making in the town. Yep. So that is, I think, one step. I've actually found most of the people that I'm working with in this resiliency working group, they are pretty good about translating it. So I think many of them know that that's what they have to do. So then it is trying to be compelling about why the investment that you're going to make in this area is as important or more important than some of the other investments that they have. And that goes into more broadly understanding what risk calculation is a senior making right now when they're talking about their budgeting and resources. And is it a health and safety issue? Is it a finance issue? You know, human resources issue. Many people say we ought to look at cybersecurity as if it were a utility, much like water, much like power, much like road services. The problem is when you have a parade, you know, Brewster and Bloom or whatever in the spring, you can't run your cybersecurity program down the street the same way you can do a fire engine, right? Or the right?
Not much of a problem today. Unless it's a very long parade with lots of space.
But sadly, because of today, because of our huge dependency right now on connectivity remotely, understanding that, yeah, I don't want anybody, you know, Zoom bombing my video or getting into my system. I, I think everybody intuitively understands that this is an important issue. And then we're not always going to get as much as we want, but I think we have to be at the table and we have to be engaged. I think that would be where I would say.
Can we just momentarily, I think that's great advice, but I just want to momentarily reflect on the fact that Zoom bombing sounds way too friendly and fun for what it is. Like, I don't think they've done themselves a service here with this term. Like, I think everyone's like, yeah, Zoom bombing. No, it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
Not a fun thing. Anyway, unless you're an adversary, in which case it's great fun and you should all give it a try. But yeah, that's great advice. Thank you. And I'm really glad that you're working through all these issues and getting the buy-in and thinking about how to slot in with what drives value for them. And anytime that you want a parade, we will just get like, we'll get a lot of dudes in black hoodies for you.
There you go, the black hoodies.
Right, we can totally make this work. We can totally do a hacker parade. But like, just understand that their slogans are going to be very snarky on the placards that they're carrying. And they're not going to look like they're having fun, but they will totally.
So mean question.
Like Todd would actually come and he would have fun. So just, you know, to wrap up, one of the things that we always try and do on the podcast is we try to give sort of practical advice to people who are interested in running their own projects in some different area. Now, it's probably unlikely that we're going to have too many listeners who are like, I want to go and build resilience for a state, or who are even in a position to be able to do that. But we might have some people who are security professionals who are interested in helping their state become more secure and offering their expertise. What would your advice be to people who are in that situation, who want to get involved in their state, but aren't really sure whether their state would be interested or you know, what the best avenue?
Well, I would say, as we were talking about, all politics are local. Cybersecurity issues are local, and you know, many of the folks that are on the strategy council have mentioned that I live in a town, and I talk to my town management about where are we in cybersecurity. Not everybody has somebody in their town that has reached out to either the town manager or even the IT coordinator for the town to offer just to be a mentor or to even just, you know, how's it going kind of a thing. So if you live in a town and you care about cybersecurity, maybe check out what the town meeting is like and maybe what your IT folks are up to, and maybe you can offer some suggestions. Now, in some cases, maybe they are not in need of help, but maybe you never know at some point in time when there's a contingency and they're like, I really sure could use somebody to run this by as a thing. So, and that's Massachusetts. Everybody lives somewhere. And whether your IT infrastructure for your city or town is governed by your county or by your city, maybe that's an opportunity to help. And I think just engaging and listening. One of the things that we did last fall was a listening tour. Part of Cybersecurity Month is going to be probably an event where we can bring municipalities together and talk about what the issues are. We had Cybersecurity Week last year in October, middle of October, and we held an event for municipalities. We learned an awful lot. We had some input. We thought we knew what the problems were, but it was really important to hear in their own words what their challenges were, what they were facing every day, and where they thought we could be helpful. So asking the question and listening to what the problems are may be a very important step as well.
That's great advice. Thank you. I appreciate it. And again, like, congratulations on the progress that you guys are making. Thank you for the work that you're doing. You know, Rapid7, as you mentioned at the start, have been trying to support as much as possible because we think it is a fantastic and important initiative and that you guys are doing really awesome work. And we particularly appreciate that it's in our backyard. So thank you. And we look forward to continue to work with you. So yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for everything you're doing, Stephanie.
Thank you.
well.
Thanks for all your help.
Okay, so thank you very much again to Stephanie for coming on and telling us about what she's doing for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And also thank you to Stephanie for what she's doing for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Not just talking about it.
Right, exactly. Actually doing stuff. We love people who actually do stuff.
It's kind of the theme of the show.
It is kind of a thing for us. Yes, it's sort of a crucial point. So what else is happening in the world right now, Mr. Beardsley? I hear that thing is still happening, that COVID thing. Still a problem.
I kind of feel like we're settling on the unpleasantness, is something to call it.
The unpleasantness. Oh, uh-huh. I like that. It's so...
It feels a little British.
It is very British. It is, but also Southern. It seems very Southern to me.
Yeah, it does. So yeah, there is a mashup of culture there. So there's a couple things I want to talk about. One, I want to give a quick plug to the Recog network fingerprinting framework. I wrote a blog about it. If you just Google like Rapid7 Recog, you can read all about it. But basically, Recog is currently my favorite open source project that Rapid7 helps out with. It's not Metasploit anymore. Metasploit has grown up, left the house. They're finding out who they are now in the world. Recog is still at home, though. Recog is the forgotten middle child that I've suddenly noticed.
Are you sure that Recog wasn't like the surprise baby you didn't expect, but but now you're just in a place where you can have fun with it?
Oh, no. We've got hundreds of those. We actually do have hundreds of open source projects. It's kind of shocking how many we have. Literally hundreds. I think it's like 200 and something.
Are we open source junkies?
A little bit. But Recog is probably the third most, what I describe it as, the third most popular open source project that we have.
Wait, what's the second?
Merterpreter, which is the Metasploit payload. So you can talk about it as part of Metasploit, but it is its own different thing. You can use, and people do, use Merterpreter by itself. But Recog is great because it is it's an open source, very open source. It's two clause BSD for licensed people who care about that kind of thing. And it lets you fingerprint devices and services. It's geared a little bit more towards devices than individual services. So like you probably know about, and if you listen to this podcast, you probably know about Nmap. Nmap is wonderful. We all love it, and we actually license it and ship it and all that jazz in Rapid7 products. But Recog's stuff is different. It is, like I said, it's more geared towards identifying devices, given, you know, a XML based fingerprint library, which is the thing that makes it cool. It's also wrapped in Ruby. So like, if you hate Ruby and hate XML, this is not the project for you. But if you are cool with either or both of those things, this is very much the project for you. You know, and by the way, if you hate it, feel free, re-implement it. It's two clause BSD. I don't care. Rewrite it in Go or Python or Rust or whatever. But just use the same fingerprint database, and because that's the thing that makes it cool. We have like thousands of signatures in there. We use it in Sonar. We use it in Nexpose and InsightVM. We use it in Metasploit, and other things use it, namely Rumble. Rumble Discovery on Twitter. It is the current passion and also money project from HD at Critical Research. HD Moore, who you may have heard of before, he's actually been on the show, and he's talked about Rumble. And Rumble is it's an asset management system that uses fun hacker tricks to like identify things. So like you can use it to do like asset management in your company. A lot of people are working from home today. So I talked to HD and he is offering Rumble for a limited free trial period right now for people who are transitioning to work at home and want to know what's on their home networks. But you can help out on a couple different
fronts, right? You can use Rumble to identify all the weirdo stuff that's in your network that you didn't know about. And you can use Rumble to identify stuff that you do know about, but Rumble doesn't know about, which tends to mean that there's lacking a recog fingerprint for that particular device. So you can just pop on over to GitHub, update the recog fingerprint, move along on your way, knowing that you have helped people figure out what the heck is going on the Ethernet around them. So that was supposed to be a quick plug. It was a little less than quick.
Well, that's enthusiasm and passion. And I am very happy to hear Recog getting some love, because it does always end up being slightly overlooked in favor of that other magnificent open source project.
Yeah, see, and Metasploit's got a bunch of rules, man. It's like hard to contribute to Metasploit these days without reading a lot of docs. But Recog is fresh and fertile and easy to just kind of jump in. It's a much smaller project, so it's easier to like kind of get your whole hands around it. Nice. Rather than with Metasploit, you tend to have to like pick a spot and, you know, kind of focus on that.
Very cool. And props to HD for offering the free limited term license. That's cool. So yeah, if you are wondering what to do to get involved in something, feeling like you're lacking a little bit of community, this could be a good thing for you to do, to get involved, have a look. Okay, what else is happening in the world? What non-Rapid7 things are happening in the world?
Right. So in tech and security news, I think the biggest thing to get announced that's been kind of a rolling announce is the Apple and Google partnership on developing contact tracing technology. And I don't want to say app, because specifically they're not building an app. But what they are building is an API that works on iPhone. So it's a common language for iPhone and Android to facilitate contact tracing, which is the first thing.
And what is contact tracing?
So contact tracing it's something that epidemiologists do. So in the time of an epidemic, or pandemic, if
how,
you get sick,
how very topical.
epidemiologists come in and say like, oh, you got sick. Let's find out where you've been for the last 2 weeks. People tend to be pretty poor witnesses of their own life. They don't know where they were like 3 or 4 or 7 or 11 days ago, like exactly. They often forget things like, oh yeah, I went to the grocery store to get beer, you know, like someday, or, oh, I ran into a neighbor, you know, 9 days ago. Incidentally, this is why like eyewitnesses are really not great witnesses, except we treat them as first class evidence in court. It's a little weird, but contact tracing is important to tell like where, like how you picked up whatever it is, whatever virus it is, right? And obviously we're talking about COVID-19 here. Contact tracing is super hot right now, and Apple and Google are throwing in on this. And so that ends the factual part of the reporting. Now on to opinion.
Which is basically what we all care about.
Yeah. So like it's interesting to me because there are good cryptographers and people who know what they're talking about, who are around the spectrum on this. I don't think it's like, it's not universally seen as a good or bad move. I don't know if it's 50-50. I don't think I'm both sizing this, but there are significant opinions, pro and con. So like the con opinion is it is impossible to do this and also maintain things like privacy and security. It just cannot be done. And the pro is Apple and Google have released the documentation and it's pretty okay, especially in the time of an emergency. And so for me, at least I'm landing on the pro side. I am an optimist and Pollyanna about some things. I do think Apple and Google have some of the smartest cryptographers on the planet. They're not the smartest. Those guys work at the NSA.
Hey, they might work for other governments too.
There are other wonderful governments that, that hire cryptographers as well.
Oh, I feel like that really stuck in your throat to say.
It, yeah, boy, NSA is so a game when it comes to this kind of stuff. The docs are pretty good. Like, they're pretty solid. And that's like kind of point one in favor, is they have released docs. And they've released like the entire framework. Point two is that it's a framework and not an app. So it is an API. It enables application building. If it does screw up, it will almost certainly be the app's fault and not the API's fault. Mm-hmm. So when you're building software, right, like you build an application, and that's the thing that, you know, has the buttons and the thing that people touch. almost always, it leverages some onboard API. So like that is written by the maker of the operating system for the mobile operating system. So in this case, it's Apple and Google for iPhone and Android. So they are enabling, so they're basically making it easier to do contact tracing through Bluetooth touches. So like, you may not know this, but your phone has a Bluetooth radio and it's always pinging out and it's always saying like, hey, Bluetooth friends, where you at? You know, even when you're out and about. What Apple and Google are doing is making you able to use that Bluetooth signaling in a reasonably, which is a matter of opinion, reasonably secure way. So it doesn't do things like, I don't know, upload all of your stuff to a central database so everyone can paw through it and find out where you've been for the last month and a half, right? Like that would be generally bad.
What if you're like me and you mm-hmm. consistently turn your Bluetooth off?
Then you would be opting out. And which is kind of point three here, is that Apple and Google are very much making this kind of an opt-in. It is a voluntary kind of regime that they're offering here.
Funny how the word regime really sounds very voluntary.
Well, we'll see how voluntary it really is, though. In all likelihood, any app that ships is technically voluntary. I can envision a future where it's like, sure, it's voluntary, just like having a credit card is voluntary. Like, good luck participating in modern society without some kind of credit card or a social security number or something like, you know, so like, it's voluntary, but with teeth, right? And so I do trust, generally speaking, I trust the API. But like I said, like there are informed opinions that is kind of both sidesy here. This is not like a climate change both sides. Like some scientists disagree. This is like very, you can go look up your own references. I think the most cogent argument I've seen saying like this is a bad idea is from Moxie Marlinspike, who has a super fun name to say.
And he's a privacy advocate, so that makes sense.
He's a privacy guy. He's the force behind Signal, and he's a, you know, top notch cryptographer that does not work at the NSA. So
what? How is such a thing possible?
You're right. No, he is. He is top notch. And he's, you know, he has concerns. The main concern I have about this stuff that I think Moxie talks about is the ability to basically be a jerk using some of these apps. You know, I'm reminded strongly of the kids in Wuhan in China, where they had shifted to a, you know, school from home, setup. And
did you just correct yourself from using the word regime?
Uh-huh. I felt like I was using the word regime too much. So they moved to work from home and they figured out that if they downvoted the app that they got their homework on, they would no longer get homework. Right. So they kind of all just gave Ding Talk this one star review, which is the app that gave their homework, and it got yanked from the Apple Store. So this is an example of like, oh, okay, so creative people are going to jack around with this data a lot. I can totally see, you know, high school kids saying like, oh, I'm really not interested in going back to school. I kind of like this work school from home thing.
Right.
So I'm just going to flood with a bunch of false positives. I'm just going to keep saying that, oh yeah, I'm totally infected. I'm infected. And everybody, and also I've seen everybody and they're infected too. Like, and just slamming out a bunch of bad data, right?
Cunning.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is exactly what happens when you have an anonymous platform. You know, it's like it's the 4chan of contract tracing. So not super great. You know, so that would be a downside. But this is, again, this is something that an app could mitigate, or an app might say like, no, we're gonna not let you be anonymous to for it or whatever. And people are gonna have to decide whether they want it or not. If it is truly voluntary, you're gonna have less opt-in, but maybe that doesn't matter because maybe you only need maybe 10 or 15% to opt-in to make it useful. And I can tell you, like, epidemiologists love this kind of thing. Like, this is the kind of tool set that epidemiologists of the past wish they had. You know, it's like, wait, you are carrying around a device that is recording exactly who you were near for the last 2 weeks, and that is gold for assuming that you don't muck with the data. That is real gold for people doing contact tracing.
It does seem though, assuming the data piece feels like a
Yeah,
bit.
and that's the thing. It's like you have to assume that the people using it are altruistic. They want to help. I think you can probably box people out if it's shown that they're giving a lot of false data. It's like, no, you're a jerk. You don't get to use this anymore, and we don't get to, sorry, we just don't get to do it.
Are you proposing a pop-up that says you're a jerk?
Yeah, stop being a jerk. Come on, I mean, we're trying to get back to normal here. You can have a system where, like a credit card, like you don't get to participate in society without this thing, so it's not really that voluntary. Like, this is what they're doing in
I
Wuhan
mean,
now.
that sounds not very voluntary at all. That's true.
It's not like, so in Wuhan right now, they have this notion of a green, yellow, red QR code, that it's your health QR code, and you scan it like when you go to the subway or you go to like the mall or whatever. And if it doesn't come up green, you don't get to enter. So now you have huge incentive to cheat, right? So, like, you can, there will be ways to hack it, and it'll be a whole thing. So I do think it's on the whole positive. It will make the job of containing future spread, easier. But it's not gonna, it first off, it doesn't solve the immediate problem of there's like basically no testing in the US or UK. And so, like, in the areas where you have these, you just have continuing, upward trends of new cases, it's not for that, but it's also not for that, right? Like, it is for the future. So we haven't seen any apps that actually use it yet. We'll see how they come out. But on the whole, I think it's neat, and I hope, and I'm wishful that people will just not be jerks for just like a second, and give this thing a chance once we're in a position where we could actually use it.
Okay, cool. I'm still not turning my Bluetooth on
It's okay if you do. It's fine.
though. All right. Well, thank you for talking us through a bit. I appreciate it. Again, thank you to Stephanie, our special guest for this week. Thank you to Todd for being an amazing co-host yet again. And plugging Recog to everybody.
Yep.
And thank you to our amazing producer, Bree, who is self-isolating but has not managed to figure out how to isolate herself from us just yet. We hope that you guys are all doing well, and we look forward to next episode. Thanks.